Introducing Coco Gauff's signature shoe, more than just a tennis shoe. It's a fusion of 90s-inspired style and cutting-edge performance technology. With its sleek mid-cut silhouette, it's designed to enhance speed and power on the court. The multi-piece upper construction delivers high-energy return for players of all levels. Whether you're a seasoned pro or just starting out, the Coco CG1 empowers you to dominate the game. Learn more and purchase the Coco CG1 at NewBalance.com.
Welcome to Three, a part of the Tennis Channel Podcast Network. I'm Gil Gross with Joel Drucker and Amy Lundy, getting together as we go into the quarterfinal of Monte Carlo. Novak Djokovic coming off of a win over Lorenzo Musetti. We're going to get into that. We're going to go back to everything that went down from the split of Goran Ivanišević to the withdrawal from Miami, looking ahead to clay court season and the rest of Monte Carlo as well. But let's start with what we witnessed this morning just off the top, and it's the win over Musetti. Same round, same opponent as last year's defeat at the hands of the Italian. And, you know, Musetti has always played Djokovic tough. Joel, what did you make of Novak's performance in that one?
Wow, he was serving 1-3 at out, point to go down, two breaks, gets out of it. Again, Musetti serving 4-3-40 love. Misses a quite makeable forehand and ends up losing that game. I think Novak kind of fought through it. You know, he fought through it. Musetti's kind of, he's a the classic dangerous opponent. You know, one-handed backhand down the line. One of his signature shots. And it's a good effort from Novak. But, you know, obviously, he's obviously, like we like to say, scratching for form.
Yeah, I agree. I thought he, level-wise, he played all right. You know, fine. In the big moments, he was way more reliable. And, you know, Musetti, there were mental cracks. Like, he missed a forehand up 40 love in that first set to go up 5-3. That was a really, really easy forehand. And it just went off the rails rest of that game. Terrible mistakes. Gives Djokovic the break back. Then there were just a couple moments, you know, 30 all, second serve return, miss. And, like, those are the kind of things that were happening with Musetti. And Djokovic, the best, one of the best things about his performance is he was solid on big points, which goes such a long way. Also, what did you make of the court position difference, Joel? I felt Novak was pretty suffocating with the way he was returning second serves, which was pretty weak. You know, Musetti's second serve was kind of sitting there and was actually able to, like, rush Lorenzo, even though it's a slower surface Monte Carlo. I thought that he was really kind of getting up inside the baseline and not giving Musetti a lot of time to operate and kind of forcing him to attack or get hurt, because any ball that was dropping short, Novak was, like, right on top of it because he was taking so much time away.
Well, that's a good way to play Musetti, because you want to hit him before he hits you, and he likes to set up, and he's got the long take back. You know, he needs a lot of time and space to set up that one-hander. And Novak, it's interesting. It's so interesting the things we've learned about over the decades about the two-hander, how compact it can be and how much you can take time and space away with it in a way that was once not thought, because, and it exposed, you know, you kind of expose it. I mean, Musetti has some limitations, though. He's so fun to watch when he's playing well, but you almost see him as kind of a foil like player for Novak. I mean, they've had many good matches. He's beaten Novak. He was leading Novak 1 year, two sets to love at Roland Garros. So Novak is, you can only imagine the thickness of the scouting report Novak has on Musetti.
Yeah.
And Novak is incredibly good at noticing when his opponent is self-destructing, or not self-destructing, but beating himself. And sometimes even to the fan's eye or the viewer's eye, they don't even realize what's happening. Because, like you said, Gil, a missed return here, you know, a makeable forehand there, and some shorter points on a surface that is not as prone to shorter points. And before you know it, one guy is just not beating himself, and then the other guy is.
Yeah, particularly in when nerves come into play. I wonder also, though, in terms of the scouting report, if it is, look, we really need to strip him of time and take the ball as early as possible when going at that back end, because it is so long. Bigger picture, Amy, the expectations coming into Monte Carlo, not that high for Novak, given the withdrawal in Miami, the reason cited for the withdrawal in Miami, the recent history in Monte Carlo and his tendency to kind of build up as the clay court season goes on. The first round victory by Novak was commanding. He beats Musetti, who's, this is his, probably his best tournament, his best surface, no doubt. So in that respect, I think that Djokovic has been a lot better than maybe it would have been reasonably expected.
Yeah, and he has a home there. I think you said both his kids were born there. There's a lot of family and friends around, so there's a lot of other commitments. Not that he's ever kind of let that get in the way in the past, because he has won here, but you wouldn't expect him to win the tournament necessarily, or you might not have picked it, just given everything that you said. But, you know, as I wrote last week, he is one of the greatest clay court players of all time. So you do bear that in mind. And he knows what he's doing out there. So I like the attitude, though. His attitude right now, chose not to play Miami. You know, that's his business. That's his right, especially at 36 years old. Gonna warm up with Monte Carlo? Yeah. Gonna do what he does? Gonna play the way he does? Get down a break? I just like the attitude that, like, I'm the GOAT, kind of, without saying it, but and I'm gonna do what I do. And the rest of you can just watch.
And Monte Carlo, kind of the in American baseball terms, the spring training of the clay court season. You know, it's like the early part. You know, I know Nadal won it several times, and I forget if the years Novak won Roland Garros, how he did it Monte Carlo, but it's kind of like a no-lose quality of Monte Carlo.
2014 and 2016, I believe, were Novak's Monte Carlo titles.
So he won. That was the year he ended up winning the French in 16.
Yep.
Right. So but it's kind of like a no lose. It's kind of like in golf terms, it's like a mulligan. You win it, you're good. If you don't, this is okay. Early days, we get a lot of clay ahead of us.
It was a pretty headstrong decision to pull out of Miami, and also not make up an injury excuse, not say sick, struggling with my shoulder hurts. Just like, nope, family, I'd rather not. Not my priority right now. Is that kind of what you were referring to there, Amy? Like, he's doing what he wants?
And 2 days later, I'm going to run down to the beach in Miami. Hey, I'm still here. Tournament's going on. I ain't playing, but I'm going to go for a little jog on the beach. Yeah, I like it. Look, he deserves it, man. Like, the career he's had, the things that he's done, he can play whatever he wants to play at this point.
And he might well have had an injury, though. He just wouldn't want to say it.
But why would he say, maybe you've seen this before. I've never seen someone pull out of a tournament and say, I it's time, really, I want to prioritize my time with family. And then Goran said the same thing in his interview with Sasha Osmo, that Novak's focus at the time, even leading up to Indian Wells, was not quite as what it would normally be, not quite as tennis heavy and more off-court focused.
I like the answer that Novak gave to Prakash. I think it was yesterday after his first round win, where Prakash said, just kind of point blank, what's more important to you this year, Roland Garros or the Olympics? And Novak, very, very short order, came out and said the Olympics. I mean, he's just like doing what he wants to do, answering the question directly, saying what he feels. I'm there for it. I like this.
Let me correct the record. I said 14 and 16. It's 13 and 15.
Oh, so, okay.
Okay, so he did not win.
Go on to win year.
Okay, good to
neither
know.
Here nor there.
Well, yeah. Well, 2013 was so close. That was the epic five-setter against Nadal in the semis. Probably would have beaten Ferrer in that final. And then 15 was the loss to Wawrinka in the Roland Garros final. Maybe his two biggest what if Roland Garros years, right?
I doubt there's any correlation. Like, if he wins this year, don't panic, folks.
No, well, no, I think that's the thing, and that goes back to Joel's spring training. It's always been, at least in recent years, the cardio at Monte Carlo is not there yet. And Clay, long rally, long rally, long rally. He just hasn't been able to do it at Monte Carlo. And then he starts to get into better and better shape. And, you know, even sometimes when he's trying to build up his forehand for the clay this time of year, not quite there at Monte Carlo. And then by Rome, he's playing the kind of tennis that he needs to play in order to win Roland Garros. So it's been that slow build every time. And this is probably maybe up there for the best that he's looked at Monte Carlo in the last several years. But I didn't expect that given the fact that he, you know, felt, I think for motivational reasons, did not want to play Miami. So I just think it's a good sign for Novak, mm-hmm. ultimately.
It's interesting.
But Joel, I don't think, you're not convinced that the reason he pulled out of Miami was because of motivation, or you are going with that?
I don't know. I just see statements and actions. Yeah, he didn't want to play it. And he came up with the best way to say he didn't want to play it. And I'm not trying to say, oh no, he's hiding an injury. I just think it's kind of like reminds me when people say, and well, you know, a lot of the game is mental. All errors are mental. I just didn't send the, you know, it's like, yeah, it's all mental. What else is it? I mean, so it's kind of like he didn't want to play the tournament. And he said in the best way possible for him why he didn't want to play it. And of course, we have no idea what's going on with his body, mind, family, the stuff with Goran. You know, that's the whole thing with tennis that's so hard to get at, is what these other things, that becomes kind of, you know, political science.
Fair enough. Alex de Minaur is next in Monte Carlo. We'll hit that at the end of the show, but let's go to Goran now. After the Sinner loss at the Australian Open, after the Luca Nardi loss at Indian Wells, it was clear that something was a little bit off. Obviously, he didn't look close to himself in any of those particular losses, but it's always a shock, no matter what. Even if, you know, 5 years is a long time and it was a very successful partnership, it's always a shock to see something that works so well in Ivanisevic Djokovic, because it was remarkable the work that they did together over that 5 years. To see that come to an end, there's never preparing for that. Just like we were shocked when it went from Vida Ivanisevic combo package to just Ivanisevic himself. So, you know, Amy, what was your level of surprise given what we had seen on court, but also knowing what we saw, or knowing what we know about the long-term successful nature of their partnership?
All due respect to Goran, I was actually surprised it hadn't happened sooner, only because Novak is known to tinker and change things up. And, you know, I think I remarked to somebody who a fan maybe on social media who said, Goran and Djokovic have been together for a long time. And I might have said something like, well, just wait, you know, and then 2 weeks later it happened. It's the great testament to Novak is that he remains on really good terms with all these people, Boris Becker, you know, even people that he had short-lived stints with, like Agassi and Stepanek. But he does make changes. And so now we have a new coach.
You know, I think sometimes with this coaching thing in tennis, these coaches have like a 2-year first renewal maximum. It's almost like 2 years into it, the protocol should be the player and coach ought to take this kind of like macro offset and figure out what it's about now, why they're even working together after 2 years and what they bring. I mean, because I think I mean, it's funny. I've hit with a few juniors lately and talking with their parents about instructors and coaches, just the whole dynamic around this, I find very distinct and sometimes strange right up to the pro level, you know, mm-hmm. like it reminds me of like when Federer was working with Edberg and why that was different than Anacone, and what those mean to the particular player, and how little we know, or what we think we know, or why it happens. Remember, the player grows up with coaches as employees. The whole time you're playing tennis, the coach is you're paying for him. Different than just any other sport.
Yeah, it's certainly different, and there's definitely a lack of information and a lot of bad assumptions that are sometimes made by fans and sometimes even media when observing player coach stuff. And for example, you know, before Goran gave that interview, the reason for the split really wasn't known. Not that everything needs such a reason, especially when you work with someone for 5 years. It's a really long time. It's not, if you work with someone for 2 months and then there's a split, something happened. There's a disagreement, you know, clearly something happened. But after 5 years, it doesn't have to be something happened. It might just be time. Like, nonetheless, and that's basically, Goran basically said, look, there was fatigue. He was tired of me. I was tired of him. that's what was said. And it's like, these things have an expiration date sometimes. What people were kind of looking at, or some people, and Goran spent a lot of time trying to dispel this in his interview, was like, people wanted to say, well, because of all the tense exchanges that Novak had with Goran on court, that was a signal that their relationship was fractured.
Introducing Coco Gauff's signature shoe, more than just a tennis shoe. It's a fusion of 90s-inspired style and cutting-edge performance technology. With its sleek mid-cut silhouette, it's designed to enhance speed and power on the court. The multi-piece upper construction delivers high-energy return for players of all levels. Whether you're a seasoned pro or just starting out, the Coco CG1 empowers you to dominate the game. Learn more and purchase the Coco CG1 at newbalance.com.
Right. Yeah. And that was written a lot.
Well, that's right. And that's where it gets in this whole realm. It's kind of like the thing with Novak pulling out a tournament. You get into this kind of like, you know, what observational commentary, who knows what the nature of their interactions is away from cameras, how they connect with each other, how they talk with each other. And then, of course, now there's this, in the last couple of years, the legalized mid-match coaching. And what's going on with that? Are they happy? Are they getting on? What's going on? Oh, he glared at him. He glared at him after the break point. I mean, he's like, God.
I think every like dynamic between a player and a coach, and even when that coach changes, is unique. And I think of Tiafoe, who had, you know, a coach that he was really close to for a few years, and they were close in age, and then he wasn't getting to where he wanted, so bittersweet, you know, parted ways with him, and then went to Wayne Ferreira, and the first thing Ferreira said is, start running, go for a run, and you're not allowed to use your headphones or listen to music, bring your phone, you just have to go for a run. Like, he told him what to do, and that is something that maybe the previous coach would not have done. So like, every dynamic is just a little bit different, and as Joel interestingly points out, now you have this new thing thrown into the mix, which is in-match coaching, legalized. And so that's a thing, and everybody's watching. I will tell you, just as an aside, what I was shocked at was that Novak parted ways with his longtime agent.
Was last year.
Yes. That was a shock when that happened. Eduardo was with Novak for years and years and years and years. So he had kind of outlasted many, many regimes. But I think it just goes back to what I said in the beginning, which is, he's a tinkerer, both with his technique and with his off the court stuff and his recovery and, you know, with his team around him.
There's not a lot of time also. Like, it's, clock is ticking, couple years left, you would think. So if stuff went flat or started to get stale, and it seems like motivationally, at least in March, it did, that might, maybe there's nothing Goran could have done about that. But there's a sense of urgency, I think, this year. Olympics, you know what I mean?
Here we go. I mean, I think urgency, it's yes and no. I mean, the guy won 3 majors last year. There's another sense, there could be another sense of kind of like, let's enjoy the ride. Let's try a few more little experiments. Yeah.
But I mean, doesn't that's why people were surprised. That's why it felt like a very quick out of nowhere decision. Cause last year was so good.
Tennis. I like what Amy talked about the tinkering, and maybe Novak thought, you know, this is maybe Novak thought, hey, look, let me just, I don't want to just ride in with the old team right to the end. I want to try something to the end that's a little different. The manager, his work is done. He got me all my, he's done his work. He's got my deals. Let me see what else someone else might bring to me.
New is exciting.
Yeah, new is exciting. But urgency, that's 37 years, 30, he's going to be 37. He won a zillion titles. It's all good. Enjoy it. It's all gravy.
Once you feel like it's all good, I think you're done winning.
Oh, no, it's not done winning. I mean, I don't know, really?
I don't think that can be the mentality. I don't think all good. I think all good is a death sentence. That's when you stop winning.
I think urgency.
Gravy is a death sentence.
I think urgency is a sentence. I think urgency is another thing. It kind of gets to our whole, this is like a continuation of our prior dialogue about terms and ending. And maybe looking how we're looking at the lenses we look at the periscope through. Urgency, you can create urgency around anything, or you can create urgency around nothing. And whether it's urgency or complacency, right? That's kind of the implication of it's all good. It was always good for Federer. He knew he was Roger Federer. You know, the whole thing about, oh, like I always like it again when I hear the phrase, oh, you've got nothing more to prove. What did I have to prove to anyone anyway? What does anyone have to prove? You know? So again, I just think this whole, I think we're onto an interesting dialogue with Novak and Rafa about late stage career. You know, I'm not stupid enough to think, oh, it's all good. They're right in the middle. We all know it's closer to midnight for these guys than it is to dawn. But I don't know.
We're in the now. We're
in the now. Yeah. We're playing Alex Dimonar. You know what I mean?
I think the constructs that we're talking about, is it better to create urgency or is it better to have complacency? It's all gravy. It's kind of an artificial construct that the three of us are kind of forming. I mean, it's fun to talk about, but Novak is in such rare air. There's nobody like him, and there's nobody who's done what he's done. So whatever he sets up with himself in terms of motivation will be kind of uncharted territory. So therefore, maybe we just kind of observe and not try to figure it out too much.
You know, I think urgency, I was reeling through my head while we've been chatting about late stages of certain players and how they managed it. And Pete Sampras hadn't won a title for a couple of years, and he created a little bit more the desire to compete well. I mean, other players, I don't know, I think Martina Navratilova, yeah, the urgency, look, competition creates urgency. I get it in the moment. I get that. But I mean, the management of one's time and career, I do what I do. I like winning tennis matches. I like playing tennis matches. What will be, will be.
Yeah. I think it feels different when it's your last Olympics. This is it.
Well, the Olympics is an interesting thing. You're right. And Novak, well, I don't think in his like, for example, if Novak doesn't win the Olympics, it'll mean zero on his legacy evaluation. However, his affinity with Serbia and his desire to excel there, and he's had some frustrating moments there. I get that. Mm-hmm. I get that. Maybe that's what this is. Maybe that's what this really is. I don't know. I mean, players have a way of, you know, articulating their own priorities. Right. He's won all these other ones multiple times.
It's interesting that he chose a Serbian coach now leading into the Olympics. There may be something with that, you know, surround himself with his fellow countrymen.
Well, that also plays into something that Andy Roddick said, and I agreed with in the moment when, you know, when the Goran split first happened, and one of the questions that was being asked is who's next, as if this is like back to Joel, you'll appreciate this, as if this is like the NHL or the NFL and it's like Chip Kelly's a free agent, you know, like it's not, there's too big a pool in tennis to even wrap your head around. Like, I predict it's going to be this person. But I think what was expected is that Novak is going to go to familiarity, someone who he knows. And again, I think what stage of his career he is in comes into play here. You're 36. This isn't time to experiment. This isn't time to go out into the free market and forge new relationships with people who you don't know or trust. You've been around the block. You know a lot of people in this game. It's very important, you know, especially because this happened in March. You have to have something that you're comfortable with quickly. Roland Garros, Wimbledon, Olympics, US Open. It's gonna come at you fast. So this isn't time to potentially bring in something that you are unfamiliar with. Nenad Zimonjic is someone who he's known for 15, 20 years. He knows exactly what he's getting. And I think that's a big thing.
Yeah, agreed. I liked the point you made, Amy, about the Serbian connection and maybe the Olympics. And that could be kind of interesting. Yeah. Of course, in tennis, when do players hire someone who they've never met? I mean, sports teams hire coaches who their players haven't met, maybe, right? Like this guy had been coaching college and now he's going to coach the NFL team. But I'm thinking about in tennis, not that they know that, they have to know that well. I mean, it's such a personal sport. You know, they're sharing practice courts. Do you know what I mean? They're adjacent. They're practicing with the other team. There's a lot of contacts. So I'm thinking, who would Novak not know? I mean, you know what I mean?
Yeah, I know that when players do like a search, you know, in the interview process, they talk to some people who sometimes they talk to some people who they don't actually know, but they know of their work and what they've done and their resume. Usually there's some sort of a connection. This person.
I know. It's just an interesting thing, but I think you had a great point. You're right. At this point, Novak wants something.
Here's a question. Did Jannik Sinner know Darren Cahill? Did he know him?
I knew more of him. Right. That's a great point. Yeah.
Yeah.
And to your point, like Murray hiring Mauresmo, that was highly experimental and different and like new, and let's give this a spin. Now's maybe not the time to do that, something like that for Novak. So he went with familiarity and comfort.
Yeah. In terms of the rest of clay season and the rest of Monte Carlo, I do want to hit the Demonor match specifically in a second, but like, at what point do the alarm bells kind of quiet down in terms of what he looked like against Nardi and the uncharacteristic performance against Sinner, giving the start of 2024 this twinge of like, oh no, like have we kind of reached a point where Djokovic is he not going to contend for all the biggest titles for the rest of the year and win several of them? Is that not the kind of year he's going to have? At what point do you think we'll know and understand what the answer to that question is? And I'll say what I said after he lost to Nardi was, talk to me after Roland Garros. That's what I said. Well, do we like that?
I'll say if he wins a title prior to Roland Garros, I think that's a good indicator. If he reaches a final and the guy beats him in a zoning effort, you know, the guy who beats him in the final plays a tremendous match, I think that's still okay. You're in there, Novak. If he doesn't do that, then I see let's see what happens at Roland Garros, but we'll see.
Even if he did not win Roland Garros or contend or what have you, I'm still like, quote unquote, not worried that we're on the downward trajectory, never to come back up again. Both the losses that you mentioned, Gil, the one to Sinner and the one to Nardi, are kind of, I hate to say this, kind of throwaways for me. Like, cares kind of thing. Because there are legitimate reasons why he didn't maybe perform up to peak. So I don't know. Wake me when... I don't know if you ever need to wake me. To
sure.
Be honest.
I mean, look, at some point it'll happen, right? Like at some point. So are people way too quick to say it's now?
No,
100%. And we've seen that time and time again. We've seen it time and time again.
This is the sport. I think the sport lends itself to it because it's individual. So it's always lent itself to it. But I think the last, 10 years have made it even more. It's like a power upgrade, have made it even more so. Everything from the decline of certain mainstream media to the lack, to the access that there's like social media. It's not just a hot take. It's a quick take. It's a fast take. It's a now take. And it's, see, I told you he's never, kind of a highly outcome-based predictive. Yes. Yes.
Yeah. So, Amy, you feel like the two losses can be explained in simple terms? We won't break it down fully, but is it for you, does it kind of go like the illness stuff and the excellence of Sinner in Australia and the fact that it was the start of March and Novak just wasn't all that motivated and focused when it comes to Nardi?
The Australian Open, it's kind of like Sinner emerging as a major elite, plus been there, done that. What do I have to prove here? And he may not even like cognizantly realize that, or it may not be in his conscience, but the loss to Nardi, like, what do I got to prove? You know, like it would be normal not to be motivated to in that situation. So I can explain it. And also, I just don't care that much. I mean, I care, obviously, but, you know, I will start to dial in now leading up to Roland Garros and watch and see what's going on.
Well, so Australia, I was okay. Also, looking at just the outlierness of it, because it was the first bad performance at a major in like about 5 years. So,
Fair enough.
It's going to happen, right? It's just going to happen. And then Indian Wells, as bad as the level was, first set was as bad as I've ever seen him play, maybe, against Nardi. It was like, he hasn't done well at Indian Wells since 2016, like it's been forever. He doesn't play well this time of year generally. So it was like, okay, you can freak out about it, or you can just be like, yep, this has been normal. And then he wins three majors. Like, this is just what happens. Mm-hmm. And that's why I also feel like, okay, clay court season, we're going to have a better idea when this clay swing is over about where he's actually at and what kind of year this is. Because again, at some point it will happen. Like, there's going to be a decline in results.
Yeah, now we have a good long buildup to the long major. It's funny how each of these majors has a buildup that's almost fitting with how it's played. I figured, of course, the buildup for Roland Garros would be the longest, and grass is kind of quick, and it's sort of in the middle Goldilocks with the two, pretty much two hard court events that the top players play. And I think the early part of the year, remember Novak, for all we know, Sinner, is this his 2008, the way it was for Novak when Novak first won the Australian 16 years ago? Or was it even 2011 when Novak won his second major and ended up having his first tremendous year and pretty much became the guy? And
I got to think it's 2011.
For Sinner?
He's playing stratospheric level.
A colleague of mine said, talk to me after Roland Garros. If Sinner goes on, let's see what happens. I mean, yeah,
he's stratospheric, but Alcaraz beat him.
I know, but
he's not untouchable.
No, he might, he's lost two matches in the last
six months.
I mean,
oh no.
Remember this, we were talking this way about Alcaraz a year ago or so.
Well, yes. Know? After Wimbledon last year, Alcaraz hadn't lost much over the season. It was like he had won, I think, five titles in eight events or something like that.
Right. He was hot. Yeah. Yeah, that's right.
Hot. That's a good word. Hot. Yes.
Yeah. Well,
people get on streaks, you know?
They do. They do. But still, this is, I got to, I'll say this is Sinner's 2011. I don't think it's a 2000.
Okay. All right. We'll hold you to that.
Well, hold me to that. Hold me to that.
That means you're opining that Sinner's going to win two more majors this year?
No, I wouldn't go that far. I think he could. I think he could.
Oh yeah, no one would disagree with you on that. It's just I think Novak is still kind of in waiting, and I think the year round nature of the sport, the world of social media again makes the news cycle. I don't even call it a cycle anymore. I don't even know what to call it. You know what I mean? It's like there aren't even cycles. It just goes and things happen, and guys win, and there's dialogue and stuff, you know.
Yeah, a lot of freaking out all the time. Yeah, no doubt. Well, okay, Alex de Minaur has also been on a excellent run of form that has been good enough to get him inside the top 10. And, you know, we like to talk like Djokovic has only lost two matches this year. He's actually lost three. He lost to de Minaur at United Cup to start the year. I barely remember it. I watched it even, and it's just like it didn't hit as hard as the next two losses, probably because Novak was, it was pre-Australian Open, and there is nothing about the way Djokovic played that made anyone too worried. But de Minaur has been tough as nails, not very good on clay usually.
Right.
But I actually think he is going to be an interesting test for Djokovic because he's going to lengthen rallies and test the lungs and the legs.
Spot on. A lot of balls, a lot of rallies. De Minaur a little more old school in his racket head speed work. So it's not like he's a guy who generates this terminal power on clay. That's why he's better on harder surfaces. But God, I like him. You know, he gives you an honest day's work for an honest day's wage. And it'll be different than the kind of shot making of Musetti, you know, which is kind of like, whoa, this guy can't miss. And now this guy, okay, try to get Musetti off, weather the storm. That's when you play with De Minaur, or it's with Alex, it's different. I'm not quite sure what the motto is with him, you know, grind it through.
De Minaur is a dynamic player, both literally and metaphorically. His game changes more than you realize, especially in terms of how much he's going for his shots and his power. And he had an interview, I don't know, a couple months ago, where he was talking about how his girlfriend actually had an impact on him, Katie Bolter, because she's a power player. And he was watching her practice and basically realizing that maybe he should try to up his power a little bit. And I've seen him do that. So incredible player, absolutely incredible player. And you just don't know what you're going to get on any given day within, you know, the style that he plays.
Yeah, I totally agree with that, Amy. I think he's become one of the best chameleons in tennis.
Yeah,
he identifies what needs to be done and he'll do it. And I have a feeling, especially on slow clay, where even if he tries to be a power player, I don't know if he quite has enough muscle to execute that well. But I mean, I bet he's well aware of Djokovic's recent history in Monte Carlo and, you know, the context. And also, Musetti got things physical at one point in the second set, and there was a change of ends where Novak was looking actually pretty shaky in terms of how fatigued he was feeling, and there was like shaking in the hand a little bit, which we had seen once last year. I think the game plan is going to be like, let's make this hurt a whole lot.
For Alex?
Yeah, like let's keep these points long and physical, and let's try to just make Novak feel it in the lungs and in the legs. I really think that's going to be the plan.
That's interesting. I wonder though, then Novak. And so, no, and just, you know, not miss, like channel his inner Carreño Busta and just kind of go to work.
Just be like, yeah, I think Alex will come into the match and be like, yeah, my cardio is better than yours. And that's where we're going to find an edge.
Nobody wants to see Alex in the draw, like, because even if you can get through the match, you might be hampered in the next round. So that's a really good point, and that's a great strategy, especially given where Novak is at this particular point in time. So it'll be a fun match to watch.
So that's interesting, though. So that's kind of the opposite of the lesson Alex said he learned from his girlfriend.
Right. But as Gil pointed out, this is clay. But I mean, the greater point on Demonar was that he's a chameleon. So he may go back to what he was doing before. Who knows?
Yeah, that's interesting. I think I love that chameleon. I love that chameleon analogy. And he's an interesting player because Batista Agu. That's the more relevant one, the Eastern grip, flatter ball. And yet, yeah, there's a way I enjoyed him. And yet there's a way you could feel like just a little too flat for today's game at times. And can you sustain that? So maybe let's just see. The Novak recovery part is interesting. So, okay. All right. You want a 12 ball rally me? Okay. Let's see what we got here. And maybe does Novak then get in on him? Does Novak? That's going to be interesting. Clay is so much different now than it used to be because the ability to generate power with the strings and racket technology.
Right. And I think in any time somebody is trying to do that against Djokovic on clay, the biggest factor becomes, is Novak's forehand going to disrupt that in a way that makes it untenable? So it's like, okay, like, cool, you try to lengthen rallies, but you know, if the forehand is really on, like it has been at its peak on clay in recent years, you can't lengthen the rallies even if you try. You get pushed around and bullied and finished. So, and then, you know, he'll incorporate the drop shot. He volleyed extremely well today against Musetti.
Yes.
He got passed a ton. He kept getting passed, but whenever he got his racket on it, perfect volley.
I'm sure the new coach is getting all the credit, you know, doubles player, you know.
coaching as autobiography, right?
Yeah.
Yes. Coaching can be autobiography. Can be. It's not supposed to be, but it often is. And then it gets interpreted. It can be interpreted as such. Right. The doubles guy is time to come in. On the other hand, it reminds me of like with Edberg and Federer, I said someone, I never heard a coach tell someone to come to net less. Rarely have I heard a coach tell a player that.
Only if I were coaching Holger Rune.
Tell him to come to net less.
He's the only guy on tour I think comes forward too much.
Interesting.
That's a good idea for a story.
Yeah, I'd love to read it. Let's do it, Amy.
Okay.
That'll do it for this episode of 3. Remember, we're available on all podcast platforms. We appreciate it if you like, comment, and subscribe if you are watching on YouTube. And we will see you next time on the next episode of 3.